Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
For all the midfield skills, there were no goals in the first half, and against expectation, the two defences had held. There was even briefly a hint of stalemate. Then, in the classic Newcastle fashion, out of defence to Melbourne, an exchange with Robledo, and Melbourne was gone. Blackpool didn't give up by any means, and with Matthews constantly prompting them, they still gave the Newcastle defence some anxious moments.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Greatest Games podcast on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. With me, of course, is Jonathan Wilson. And with us is historian Dan Jackson, contributor to History Today, The New Statesman, the BBC, author of the critically acclaimed book, The Northumbrians, Northeast England and Its People, A New History, and one-time historical advisor for Cheryl Tweedy. Dan, pleasure to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here, Marcus. Thanks for inviting me.
Not at all. Today we go all the way back to the 1951 FA Cup final, Newcastle United 2, Blackpool 0. Dan, why have you chosen this game?
Well, it was the first of the three FA Cup final wins that Newcastle enjoyed in the 1950s. And it's slightly come to signify this sepia-tinged golden age for Newcastle and the Northeast to an extent, not just because these are the last domestic trophies the club has won, mm-hmm. But also because the 1950s were quite an optimistic time in the Northeast. Actually, it was something of a golden age. Its traditional heavy industries had a bit of a resurgence in Indian summer after the Second World War, and I think the success of Newcastle is bound up in a lot of folk memory, really, in the northeast of this slightly, as I said, sepia-tinged golden era that people look back on fondly, and it's mm-hmm. wrapped up in a slightly, how can I put it, nostalgic. Nostalgia is a big part of the northeast, mm-hmm. sentimentality too, and. Mm-hmm. Even 80s kids like me grew up with the stories of Jackie Milburn and so on in the 1950s.
Yeah, Dan, it's a certain club from the Northeast is often mentioned on this podcast. And I think, to be honest, this whole thing is a ruse for Jonathan to cram in as many Sunderland mentions as he possibly
We should just point out that, you know, as Dan talks about this golden age for the Northeast, the previous year, Sunderland had broken the world transfer record for the fourth time, signing Trevor Ford from Cardiff. Yeah, making them one of only five teams to have broken the world transfer record on four or more occasions, with other such giants as Real Madrid, Juventus, Inter and AC Milan.
Common bedfellows, those lot.
The Bank of England club, I'm sure Jonathan's talked about that in the past. That was Sunderland. And in many respects, Newcastle had had this in its history. Sunderland were certainly the pioneers in terms of Football League representation in the Northeast, had a great side in the 1890s and so on. Then Newcastle emerged quite strongly in the Edwardian period. There's a rather good piece on Blizzard currently about their great passing side of the of the 1900s. Where they won the league three times, they got to four FA Cup finals, won one. They had a bit of a tricky interwar period. They won the cup again in 1924 in the second Wembley final against Villa, and again in 1932 against Arsenal. But then they had a fairly disastrous decline. They were relegated in the mid-30s, and then Sunderland reasserted themselves for about the next 20 years as probably the top team in the Northeast. It was only Hitler really that interrupted Sunderland's progress, wasn't it? In the
two world wars really scuppered us. we did many other things, but let's not forget Sunderland were two games from the double in 1913. Yeah, and then they won the league in 1936, won the cup in 1937, and then they also kind of contributed to their own downfall by not renewing Raish Carter's contract after the war. And he went to Derby, got to two FA Cup finals in the first two seasons, won one of them. And, Sunderland thought he was past it and he clearly wasn't. And they then sort of, they end up chasing it a bit, spending, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds and never really got the rewards that the outlay probably demanded.
Mm. Yeah, and they even bought Len Shackleton from Newcastle in the late 40s. Was it 1947, 48, around that time? The Clown Prince, great footballer. Joe Pony, but
that was part of the problem. I mean, it was a classic case of a club with loads of money spending it stupidly. So Shackleton was a fantastic footballer, but he was not a great team man. And so when Trevor Ford arrived, the world transfer record has been broken, and Shackleton suddenly is not the king anymore, and he doesn't like this. So the story goes that he was an inside left, and you're playing the ball to Ford. And he deliberately loaded it with spin so that Ford couldn't control it. And after Ford had sort of miscontrolled half a dozen passes on his debut, Shackleton would turn to the crowd and shrug as if, what, this guy's your hero now? So there was no real sort of concept of team building. But, I mean, something we should say about this FA Cup campaign in general is that Sunderland got to the quarterfinal, drew with Wolves at Roker, then got beaten 3-1 at Molineux, and if they'd won that tie, it would have been a Tyne-Wear semi-final.
Indeed. And I wonder if that's... We've been nowhere close to a Tyne-Wear final, as far as I understand, Jonathan. I don't
Not
know.
That I'm aware of.
The semi-final would have been the closest we got in the early 50s. Indulge me for a second on the social history of football. 1951 is an interesting period because you're coming out of the austerity of the 1940s. Labour lose the general election 1951. Churchill returns, partly because people are a bit fed up with the kind of grey misery of that post-war period. So you've got 1951. It's the Festival of Britain, where a young Bobby Robson worked as an electrician and building the Royal Festival Hall when he was a young trainee at Fulham. But you've still got the sense of the Northeast having quite a bit of influence on the national stage. 1951 is also the year when there's that famous quote when Herbert Morrison, Attlee's number two, is asked about whether Britain should join the fledgling European coal and steel community. And he just dismisses it with the line, "No, the Durham miners will never wear it." Which has gone down in folklore, but I think it speaks to the power and influence of the miners' unions, particularly the Durham miners, who were incredibly influential in national affairs. And like I said earlier, there was this brief resurgence again in the 1950s of very heavy industry, and the Northeast put all its eggs in the very heavy industrial basket. But also that sense of I don't know if listeners would have read David Edgerton's book, the Rise and Fall of the British Nation, where he says, instead of a new Jerusalem, they built a new Sparta, where there's absolutely vast defence spending by the Labour governments and then the Conservative governments. And that played very nicely into the Northeast strengths as a shipbuilding base and armaments base and so on. So a growing, buoyant economy backed by the welfare state, the football team doing well. It's understandably looked back on quite fondly this era.
Yeah, and well, absolutely. So what is, you've talked about the situation in the 50s in the Northeast there.
Yeah.
Just very quickly, just to give a bit more context, what was happening in the rest of the country, if you see what I mean?
Well, the 1950s, like I said, it's a resurgence. It's an optimistic period. Mm-hmm. You've got that cushion of the welfare state with, you know, vast expansion of council housing. You've got the NHS, mm-hmm. A kind of a system of social security that, if you look back to the 1930s, which is quite an uneven picture actually. People tend to associate the 1930s with images like the Jarrow March and so on, which was representative, I think, of the situation in the Northeast, which was pretty grim, partly because their economy hadn't diversified at all. There's a moment in the early 1920s where Armstrongs, who the great manufacturer of ships and artillery pieces and so on, briefly consider manufacturing motor cars on Tyneside and then think, nah, there's no future in this. it could have been a sort of free Nissan, and yeah, then they just concentrate on heavy weaponry, which kind of goes out of favor in the 1930s. But it comes roaring back with the Second World War. So it's a buoyant economy in the Northeast after a real period of misery in the 1930s. Although, yeah, you know, as Jonathan says, you know, Sunderland did win the league. In fact, I think they're the last team to wear stripes to win the English top flight.
That's correct. That was a question in the Blizzard quiz only last night.
There you are, you see. There you are.
Yeah.
And in terms of football in the early 50s, on a sort of national scale, I think there was this incredible sense of delusion about England's importance. So England went to Turin in 1948, and they beat Italy, who of course were the reigning double world champions, beat them 4-0. So obviously it's not the same team as 38. But this is, you know, basically that side, I think 10 of them played for that great Torino team who won the five leagues in a row, obviously destroyed at Superga the following year. But that result, that 4-0 win in Turin is, I think, arguably the outstanding single result of any England national football team. I mean, obviously, winning a World Cup is a little bit different. In terms of a one-off game, to go to Italy and win 4-0 was something extraordinary. But then they go to the World Cup 2 years later and lose to the US. But somehow that message doesn't sink in. And you have then the Matthews final in 53, which is related to this game we're talking about. Because there's this sort of obsession with Stanley Matthews.
That
Matthews was the most popular, the best known, in the common perception, the greatest ever English footballer, probably the greatest footballer in the world. You know, he wins the first Ballon d'Or, and yet he hadn't won anything. He hadn't won a league and he hadn't won a cup. He'd been in the cup final in 48 and lost to Manchester United. He was in this cup final in 51, lost to Newcastle. And so 53, by which time he's 38, I think.
Eight, yeah. I think so.
And so there's this desperation for him to win. And, you know, there's Blackpool. When we did this with Seb Stafford Blood back in, I think, the fourth or fifth one of these we ever did, they're 3-1 down to Bolton with 20 minutes to go, and then he inspires the recovery. It's Matthews' final, and this sort of the English winger, the most revered creative position in the English game. Matthews, the great exemplar of that. Yeah, and so in May 53, and as we said in that podcast with Seb, it was the first final that actually got proper penetration on TV because people were buying the TVs for the coronation a few weeks later. And there's this sense that all's well with the world. Rationing's coming to an end. We've had the Festival of Britain. Austerity is over. This is his time of rebirth. And look at how great we are. Look at our form of football being as good as this. And 6 months later, they get smashed by Hungary, and it's all gone wrong.
I was going to say, Hungary put all that to bed, didn't they? soon enough. It's funny you say about Matthews, because, I mean, talk about the game more in the second half, but the commentator mentions, you know, Matthews having one last chance to get an FA Cup winner's medal he so desperately wants. And Matthews was 36 in 1951. And of course, he didn't retire until 1965. Now, I appreciate that he was less likely to win the FA Cup in his sort of 40s and so on and so forth. But yeah, they didn't realise just how long he would stay in the game. And
well, I mean, part of the reason for that is that 30 was old for a footballer in those days. People just didn't go on into their 30s. And I mean, Matthews, I mean, he was vegetarian, I think, wasn't he? But he also, you know, he famously went running on Blackpool Beach every morning. So he actually looked after his fitness. He was teetotal in a way that nobody else of the time did. So this idea you could just keep going through your 30s, never mind into your 40s, nobody really had a conception of that. They thought 30 was pretty much the end.
Yeah, and he lost 6 years to the Second World War as well. You know, prime playing age of the early 20s, early to mid-20s. You know, those players who play random wartime fixtures. I think Matthews played for Rangers for a bit. You know,
I think he was based in Egypt, I think, wasn't he? So he was doing PT work out in Egypt. And then, obviously, you know, his regiment was based near enough to Glasgow to play sort of guest games for Rangers.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen. Well, let's have a quick break, and then after which we'll talk more about the game and some of these glorious old names from English football history. See you in a moment, everybody.
It was Newcastle who provided the real thrust. Their quick breaks out of defence were always dangerous, and Milburn scored the second and conclusive goal.
And Walker slips it along the ground to Taylor, and he backheels it to Milburn and shoots, and it's a goal! A terrific goal by Milburn!
His shot hit the net like a bullet.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to The Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. So we talked a bit about Stanley Matthews before he was Sir Stanley Matthews, of course, then. I mean, that famous Blackpool front line had some players in there. I mean, Stan Mortensen as well. Obviously, Bill Perry, who would get the winning goal in the cup final. Bill Slater and Jackie Muddy, is it pronounced?
Moody, I think.
Yeah, Moody.
Moody,
yeah.
Sorry. I mean, Jonathan, there's goals in that front line, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Slater, you know, goes on to win the league three times with Wolves. You know, really good footballer. Stan Mortensen, one of the greatest English centre forwards there's ever been, scored two goals in that game we're talking about in Turin. His relationship with Matthews was clearly key to that. And yeah, we've sort of, you know, and I recognise we will have a tendency to do this, but you know, Dan and I have been beating the North East drum. You look at how many North East born players, players who have come from the North East are in the two lineups.
Yeah.
So you've got in the Newcastle team, you've got Bobby Cowley from Trimden, who worked down the pit at Horden until 1942 when he suddenly gets the call up. Bobby Corbett was from Newcastle. Charlie Crow was from Newcastle. Charlie Crow, who went on to manage Egypt, which seems an incredibly odd thing. Ernie Taylor, who would move to Blackpool, would be in that side in 1953. And his only England cap, I mean, the unluckiest bloke in the world, his only England cap comes in the 6-3 defeat to Hungary. But yeah, he's from Sunderland. Jackie Milburn, obviously from Ashington, and I suspect we might be doing some Ashington gags later on. I certainly hope and persuade Dan to do some Ashington gags later on. Yeah, then in the Blackpool side, you've got Tommy Garrett and Stan Mortensen, both from South Shields.
Yeah,
and Mortensen's still the only man to score a hat trick in the final, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, Raheem Sterling did last year, I think, didn't he?
Of course, yeah.
But until then, yeah.
Yeah, well, one lad who wasn't from the Northeast was George Robledo, or Robledo, depending on which side of the fence you fall. When I looked at the starting lineups for final, I'll be honest with you, I didn't expect to see a Chilean in there, but there he was, and he moved here when he was, I think, 5 years old. His parents came over, of course, and he and Jackie Milburn, they were the goal scorers in that side. I mean, Robledo, the first non-British registered foreign player to become top scorer in England.
Who was the second? Here's a question for you.
To become top scorer?
Yeah.
I think you might have to fast forward quite far for that.
You do.
And I think... I know Dwight York took his
Dwight York
record.
Is correct. Very good.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, Dwight York took his record because he was the highest scoring non-Irish overseas player in the English top flight until York got the record. So I've put two and two together. My favourite bit of trivia about Robledo is his winning goal in the 1952 FA Cup final was drawn by a young John Lennon, who included it in the artwork of his album Walls and Bridges in 1974. So there you are.
Yeah, and is it his goal?
Yeah, I believe that's
because I thought the point was that the artwork definitely features Milburn then, because there's a number 9 on it, which is why Lennon includes it.
Right, okay.
Because Lennon was obsessed by the number 9.
Okay.
Oh, and also the George Swindon, the Arsenal player, is in that drawing as well.
Yeah, so it was the 1952 FA Cup final,
yeah,
Newcastle
yeah.
against Arsenal.
Yeah,
which.
Yeah.
Robledo scored the goal. But yeah, I mean, we've mentioned his name a couple of times. Jackie Milburn. What a player, Dan.
What a player, yeah. He's come to represent that era and that team because he won the three. He got the three FA Cup winners' medals. I think it's just him and Cowell. Bobby Cowell got the were in the three finals.
Mitchell was as well.
Oh, Mitchell, yes.
Yeah, it was the three of them, yeah.
Signed from the famous Third Lanark. Remember them?
Oh,
yeah. It went on to be a public in Newcastle. But yeah, Jackie Milburn, I think it's a cliche to say he's a folk hero, but he really was, partly because I think the crowd saw in him a lot of themselves. You know, he was a pitman from the famous, the biggest pit village in the world, Ashington, this real breeding ground of tremendous footballers. His cousin, Sissy, whose brothers, she had four brothers who played professional football, three for Leeds, one for Leicester. And Sissy's sons were Bobby and Jackie Charlton. Incredible footballing pedigree, really, but a tremendous play. He has some, superficially, in the goal scoring record, he gets nearly 200 goals for Newcastle in about 400 appearances or so. It's up there. Shearer's got the record, and there is some superficial similarities in that the kind of local boys done well, but there's scorers of spectacular goals, different sorts of players. Milburn was famously a sprinter, a bit like Tommy Walker, who was the right winger for Newcastle that day. They sprinted at Powder Hall in Edinburgh, which is this famous meeting place of professional sprinters back in the day. But he was very fast, and he started off as on the wing, and he reverted back there in later life. But he was a scorer of spectacular long-range goals, and he got one of them that day at Wembley. But there's always been this slight hero worship of number nines for Newcastle, going back to Hughie Gallagher probably and Malcolm McDonald and Les Ferdinand and players like that. And I there's something kind of glamorous and swashbuckling about the number nine figure, which I connect back actually in the Victorian period in Newcastle, the working class sport par excellence was rowing, sculling, and there was these great contests between the Thames and the Tyne, and there was some huge popular figures such as James Renforth and Harry Clasper, kind of muscular, heroic figures. And there's a bit of a pedigree there that links the centre forward, I think, to that sense of individualism to an extent and putting them on the pedestal. But yeah, Milburn, a tremendous player, worked down the pit until 1948, until the coal dust had started to cause him trouble with his ears, I think. 13 goals and 10 caps for England, never really got going in an England shirt. And I think Tom Finney once said that he had a bit of an inferiority complex and he had to try and, you know, encourage Jackie Milburn to say, you know, you're here on merit, you know, don't doubt yourself.
Well, there's a story, isn't there, about his, I mean, I guess this links into what you're saying about his sprinting ability, that at a school sports day, and he'd already won, like, you have 100 metres and the high jump and, you know, half a dozen other events, and he wins the 440-yard dash and sort of collapses over the line, and his dad has walked in, and his dad, you know, was also a footballer, and so sees him kind of collapse over the line, thinks he's sort of showboating, and, you know, gives him a hiding for it. And it doesn't realize he's already won six other events. And so I think his dad was pretty tough on him and, you know, definitely kind of, you know, make sure you're not the tallest poppy, kind of, you know, keep your head down. So, I mean, and yeah, everybody who knew Milburn and, you know, he subsequently worked in journalism in the Northeast said he was, you know, the most modest sort of almost shy bloke. So, you know, although this sort of glamour of the number nine, and he absolutely represents that. And, you know, he's still kind of, I mean, I guess Shearer maybe has sort of come up to that level now. But when I was a kid at school, Milburn was still, you know, he is the centre forward. Yeah. And yet his personality really kind of was not that. You know, the shirt had that. He did not.
A bit similar to Bobby Charlton in that sort of diffidence and modesty. And there's footage of Milburn actually making a speech at St James's Park when the team come back, and you can tell he's a shy fella, but he makes a short, charming speech, but you can tell it's a bit of an ordeal for him.
Yeah, and there's also the thing with the Ashington accent, which maybe we should explain. Do you want to explain that, Dan?
Yeah, well, there's variations on the Northeast accent, as Jonathan will know, and one of the most peculiar variants of it is variously known as Pitmatic, which is basically the Geordie accent of the coalfield areas out of the urban kind of parts of Tyneside and Wearside. But the Ashington one is particularly peculiar. And there's a couple of old standards. One is bloke goes into a barber's and Ashington says, and the barber says, "What'll it be, sir?" And the fella says, "Well, can I have a perm, please?" And the barber says, "Certainly, sir. Mary had a little lamb whose fleece was white as snow." I don't know if these jokes travel. That's the only problem.
Well, gentlemen, let's get to the game itself. There was 100,000 people at Wembley, as there could be back in those days. And I assume it was sunny. It's hard to tell with the black and white footage. It seemed pretty clear. Yeah. So, I mean, Dan, what are your sort of immediate thoughts on the match itself? It's pretty hard to find even extended highlights of it, of course. But it was a cup final. And from what I've picked up from the commentary, if that's what you can call it, Blackpool seemed to be quite fancied in this game.
Yeah, well, it was third against fourth. Blackpool were third that season. It was the season that the famous push and run Spurs side won the league. But, you know, Blackpool in third, Newcastle in fourth, who were pretty consistently in the sort of Champions League spots, if you might describe it that way, since they got promoted in the late 40s. Pretty nip and tuck, two strong sides. And the deadlock is broken just after half time with a pass from Robledo, which finds Milburn more or less on the halfway line, unmarked. He seems to have acres of space to run into. And, you know, I think he said in later life. You know, time stood still as he kind of bears down on George Farm, the Blackpool goalie, who ended up as a lighthouse keeper, which is a good subsequent career for a goalkeeper. But anyway, he bears down on George Farm and just tucks it away with his right foot in the bottom corner while Farm sticks a leg out. And then 5 minutes later, there's a bit of play on the edge of the box. The great Ernie Taylor does a back heel, and then Milburn, which apparently Milburn called for, back heel at Ernie, and he swings his left foot at it, and it absolutely arrows into the top corner.
Oh man, it's a beauty.
It's a beauty, isn't it? And there's some great photographs of this final. There's only about a 5 minute Pathé clip on YouTube. Yeah, it's so well photographed, and there's a great one of a Farm just arms outstretched, flying through the air. You know, looking backwards as it ripped the onion bag. You know, it's a thing of beauty.
Well, Stanley Matthews called it the greatest goal he'd ever seen,
and I think Matthews shook Milburn's hand on the way back to the centre circle. You know, well done, son, kind of thing.
I have to say, I wasn't expecting that goal when I was watching the highlights. You know, one can have a stereotype of football back then, you know, not as glamorous as it would become even just two decades later. And you see the first goal, and again, the goalkeeper just sort of sticks out a leg. You know, you'd fancy a goalkeeper to smother him now or, you know, kind of spread his body or something like that. And again, it doesn't look as perhaps graceful and so on and so forth as it might do nowadays or in subsequent decades. When that goal went in, I was like, bloody hell, it's an absolute beauty. It was sort of 25, 30 yards into the top corner. It just flew in, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I think George Farm is a goalkeeper we quite rightly criticised in the podcast we did in the 53 Cup final. He does not look anything like you know, what you'd expect from a modern goalkeeper. And, you know, famously had this idea that he liked to catch the ball sort of, you know, vertically rather than getting his hands behind it.
Oh, yeah.
Like a snapping crocodile. Oh, yeah. When I first saw that goal, my instinct was, oh dear, George Farm's let himself down again. And I think the first goal, it's a pretty pathetic effort. The second goal, you could have had, you know, Peter Schmeichel and his pomp in there. It's still flying in the top corner. It's a brilliant goal.
It's a superb goal. And they're the two moments really of the game. I mean, you can tell at some points Matthews is getting frustrated and he's really trying to take the game to Newcastle and various points, but the defence stood solid and he didn't get through, Dan.
Yeah, they had some good fullbacks. And you look at footage of Matthews now, and he was obviously at the top of his game. You know, vegetarian, he used to, didn't he, was a pioneer of kind of the lower slung football boot in the late 50s and moving away from those heavy cleated boots. He was a bit of a pioneer, whereas Milburn, apparently his regular pre-match meal was two pork pies and a bottle of pop. like Stan's vegetarian diet. But you watch Matthews, and it always slightly reminds me of, you know, that Harry Enfield sketch, you know, Charlie Farns and all that dancing around the ball, because he seems to have a very, he just does that same trick where it's like one touch, two touch, then he drops the right shoulder and he tries to go past the fullback. Well, it worked for him, you know. But he missed out this year, and this set things up nicely for the 53 final, because I think he'd promised his father on his deathbed to, you know, win an FA Cup or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
But he missed out. And Newcastle had some decent fullbacks back then, apparently in Corbett and Cowell, who were quite well rated. They had a good centre half in Frank Brennan. They managed as well. The managers in either dugout are interesting as well, because you've got Stan Seymour for Newcastle, who was a sort of director manager. Newcastle were one of the last teams, I think, to appoint a full-time manager in that sense. And Stan Seymour had won the cup with Newcastle in 1924, and opposite him was Joe Smith, who played in the first Wembley final in 1923 for Bolton when they won. They took the cup.
Yeah, I mean, Stan Seymour's an interesting guy. I mean, Mr. Newcastle United, you know, people used to call him. He was attached to the club for so many years. Yeah. He was in charge during the war years and stepped down in 1947. But, well, I say he stepped down as manager, but I think he became a director or something, as you as you mentioned, Dan. But he was back in 1950. But there was something I found that was saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, the guy, George Martin, who was in charge in between, he was the one who played Jackie Milburn through the middle of the attack rather than on the wing where Seymour and one, even Jackie Milburn himself was saying, no, I'll just keep me on the wing. Don't put me in the middle. I can't. I'm not good enough, or I can't handle that. But this guy George Martin was the one who said, "No, Jackie, you're playing through the middle," and which ultimately led to the player that everybody either remembers or knows of.
Well, there's a story about Milburn, isn't there? That he went to one of these wartime friendlies in I think 43, maybe 42, and he sort of thought to himself, actually, this lot aren't any better than me. I'll give it a go. Mm-hmm. I turned up for a trial, and he used to play this trial at the start of the season between stripes and non-stripes. And he was playing for the stripes, and he played on the wing, and his team's 3-0 down at half time. He gets moved into the middle, and I think he scored 6 in the second half or something, and his team went on to win 9-3.
That's right.
The clues were there, but yeah, you're right. Is he, when he started out playing for the for the proper team, for the first team, It was a left winger, I guess, because of his pace, and there was this sort of idea that you put your quick, skillful men out wide.
Yeah. And he was always a heavy smoker throughout his life, and I think it caused the cancer that killed him. And so they say that he was declining in the mid 50s, and he was going to be dropped for the 55 final until Seymour reinstated him and went over the manager's head. And he didn't play at centre forward that day; it was Vic Keeble. And the story is in the 55 final that Roy Paul, who's the Man City captain, a minute hasn't even been played, but Newcastle have got a corner. And Roy Paul says, "Oh shit, I should be marking Vic Keeble as this big strapping centre forward," left Milburn unmarked. And he scores this extraordinary header after 45 seconds. It's worth looking up because the kind of angle looks impossible, but he kind of twists his neck, and it's a bullet header into the top corner. He wasn't known for headed goals necessarily, Milburn. But yeah, he got the winner's medal again in 55 when it was nip and tuck whether he'd play at all.
And that was the quickest goal in the cup final till Roberto Di Matteo in 97.
So that was, and that would be the last time Newcastle won a major domestic trophy. Of course, we have to say domestic because the Interfairs Trophy.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, but
which they won under Joe Harvey, who was playing at right half in this game.
No, yeah. Right.
What a generation of former Army PT instructors, and I think he may have even been part or went to learn from Walter Winterbottom's kind of innovations in coaching in the mid 50s. So quite a forward thinking. Manager, coach in that respect, Joe Harvey. But yeah, steered them in the 1969 Fairs Cup, and then stayed on the books in Newcastle more or less until he died in the late 80s in various roles.
Well, he was a manager in 74 in the cup final as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. When he looks very uncomfortable next to Bill Shankly when he's doing that conducting the orchestra thing. You know, when they sit right next to each other, the two managers, awkwardly for some reason. But yeah, the Newcastle, yeah, you're right. It's the last domestic trophy. And there is undoubtedly in the 50s, I don't know if it's the high watermark of this, that sense of the FA Cup being the most prestigious tournament to some people, having this extraordinary cachet. And I don't know if it's just because Newcastle didn't, Wyatt Earp was still breathing the last time Newcastle were champions of England in 27. But they won the cup, three times in the 50s. And the razzmatazz that surrounded it all, big day out in London, the processions back through Newcastle on those three occasions. I mean, they look like the D-Day landings or something. They're just extraordinary crowds of people. The big day out aspect of it all, I think, was important.
I think that's true right through till sort of late 80s, early 90s. I think probably till the coming of the Premier League, really, is when it really sort of flips. But I still think when I was a kid, you knew that maybe the league was the test of which the best side was, but the cup was the exciting thing to win. Yeah. And when Sunderland got the cup final in 92, it was the most exciting thing that ever happened in my lifetime. And queuing overnight to get tickets and everything, that was all part of the fun of it.
Mm-hmm. So how does football then begin to look after this kind of successful period down in Newcastle winning 3 FA Cups in pretty quick succession? And you've described the I suppose the progression and the sort of success in terms of industry and football and so on and so forth that was happening in that part of the country at the time. How then does it begin to look as it goes as you move away from the '50s into the sort of sixties?
Well, it declines pretty sharply. They're relegated in the late '50s. Jonathan will know the exact year. I think Sunderland are relegated in the late '50s as well. So
Sunderland are relegated in 1958. I'm afraid I don't know exactly when Newcastle were relegated. But yeah, Sunderland's first ever relegation was 1958.
Yeah, Newcastle were back in the top flight in 1965 under Joe Harvey's manager. Ship and then they've got a quite an exciting side in the mid 60s, and you've got players like Bobby Moncur coming through, and they win that final, and the route to the final in 69 is they play some pretty decent sides. The Rangers is the famous one that lives on in folk memory because of the enormous rammy that proceeded around the ground. But they had a reasonable team in that period. They got to the early 70s. They sign Malcolm McDonald, gets a hat-trick on his debut against Liverpool. They get to the final and it's a huge disappointment when they lose 3-0 against a very strong Liverpool side, it must be said. But the semi-final against Burnley at Hillsborough in 74 is fairly spectacular. In fact, I urge your listeners to look up the highlights of that game, because there's a pass by Terry Hibbett that plays in Malcolm McDonald that is the most exquisite thing you'll ever see. He hits it on the half volley with his left foot and just plays in McDonald, who just bears down on the keeper and smashes it in. But it's a thing of beauty. But that was a sort of high watermark. They get to the League Cup final in 76.
And get undone by one of their own as well.
By Dennis Stewart,
Newcastle fan, won the Cup with Sunderland and then scores the overhead kick, which was won the last trophy for City until Sheikh Mansour turned up.
Yeah.
And then there's a really, really steep decline in the late 70s and early 80s, and it's dismal, really pathetically small crowds. You know, you get the sense of real depression hanging over the place. Then Keegan, you know, when he comes back in the early 80s, that injects a bit more excitement into following Newcastle, and he gets them promoted in 84 and then retires, and then the rest is history.
Yeah. And we mentioned Stan Seymour, obviously, earlier. Well, interestingly, Kevin Keegan promised during his spell in charge to rename the club's youth academy after Seymour, although that wasn't carried out due to Keegan's resignation. But, that's classic Keegan stuff there. But that's the Newcastle I know, with Keegan getting them going again in, it would be the 90s, I suppose, there. But I do find it extraordinary. The club like Newcastle, you know, 1955 was the last major trophy, and they've came close. You know, obviously did the final against Arsenal, and Shearer hit the post, and so on.
And United in 99,
Yes, exactly. But unfortunately for them, they came up against two very, very good sides. You know,
it's true. But a couple of second place finishes, you know, in the late 90s as well.
Well, Dan, it was a pleasure talking about the 1951 FA Cup final with you. I'm sure certainly older Newcastle fans, well, I say older Newcastle fans, I'm not sure if anybody would listening to this podcast would have watched that game, but Newcastle fans would have enjoyed it nonetheless. So thank you very much, Dan. Really appreciate that. And as Dan said, for more stories like that, go to theblizzard.co.uk, where you can find out a lot more. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Pleasure as
Cheers,
always.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.